Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Type the words retirebarney.com into your web browser, and you'll be redirected to the campaign website of a 35-year-old Marine reservist from Brookline, Sean Bulot. The Barney, of course, refers to Barney Frank, the 30-year liberal veteran of the U.S. Congress and Sean Bulot's opponent. As you can gather from the messaging, Sean Bulot is trying to capitalize on anti-incumbent fervor in this year's heated midterm elections. In a district that has elected Barney Frank 15 times, Sean Bulot faces quite a challenge. But Congressman Frank may not be as comfortable as he'd like to be. In this year's special Senate election, the majority of Frank's district, 57%, voted for Republican Scott Brown. The election blog 538 forecasts Frank way out ahead, with 61% of the projected vote to Bulot's 37%. But the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan research group, recently shifted the Frank-Bulot contest from its solid Democratic column to its likely Democratic column. Barney Frank is a polarizing national figure, and the race has received some national attention. In the closing weeks of this election season, Sean Bulot's mission will be to make that attention work for him. Sean Bulot joins us now in the studio. Sean, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Listeners, Sean Bulot wants to retire Barney Frank. We want to know if you think he can, and we want to know what issues are important to you in the Frank-Bulot race. And we want to know if you have any questions for this political newcomer, Sean Bulot, because he's here to take your calls. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Sean Bulot, you describe yourself on your website as the first strong challenger to Barney Frank since the 1980s. But how much of that strength do you attribute to the personal qualities you bring to the race, and how many do you attribute to the current political climate?
Well, the current political climate is certainly necessary. I think it's necessary but not sufficient. There's absolutely a favorable climate for any challenger going against any incumbent. Absent that, running against the 15-term sitting committee chair is extremely difficult, if for no other reason than money. You throw in the name recognition and the gerrymandered district, and it becomes very challenging. So I'm not at all going to try to make the argument that it's purely on my own love for my qualities and candidacy that this campaign's made the progress that it has.
On the other hand, you've made the point that you think Barney Frank hasn't really been tested since 1982 because he hasn't had a strong challenger for that many decades.
That's absolutely right. If you go back the past several cycles, it's been people who didn't raise the money, people who didn't qualify for the ballot, people who didn't put an organization together. So the voters here haven't really had a challenge. And I think competition is good in just about any facet of life or the economy or politics. And so what you see is a chance for candidates to define themselves to the voters in a way that they haven't in a long time if they're an incumbent who hasn't faced a strong challenger.
A lot of your campaign, including your advertisements, focus on financial issues. Here you are speaking Monday at the Neckin debate with Barney Frank.
What we need in Congress is new thinking. We need people who are going to focus on the deficit, who are going to focus on sustainable solutions, market-based solutions, and who are going to bring real common sense and business experience to Washington.
Now, Sean Bulot, when you say market-based solutions, I assume you're not talking about TARP or the financial regulation bill. What kind of market-based solutions are you talking about?
Well, the basics of microeconomics are not in dispute, but they're often ignored by policymakers. It's not to say that government doesn't have a role in markets. It absolutely does. You need regulation. The question is, are you biased towards that regulation, or are you biased towards free market forces? I go the latter route. I think what we should do is, whenever possible, allow market forces to take a problem or an issue as far as they can, and then have the government step in only when the market's no longer able to push it any further.
I had a question for you related to that, but I think we have a caller who can ask you the question just as well.
So okay, great.
Let me bring in Sam from Malden. And Sam, what's your question for Sean Bulot?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question is, would you agree with the proposition that banks need more regulation and, in particular, the whole industry of speculation needs to be way, way reined in, and that's how we got into trouble?
Well, I don't know if it's a question of more regulation. I think it's a question of the right regulation. The problem is, we as a nation don't really understand fully what the problem is. We're operating from a base of market distortions as it is. So we're putting regulations on a foundation of other regulations. It's not to say that we don't need the government involved in Wall Street. We certainly do. The question is, do we know the best way for that to happen? And right now, I haven't seen evidence that we do. If we had, we wouldn't have seen the financial collapse that just occurred.
Sean Bilott, you're the kind of guy who basically says we have to let the free market work. But of course, as we saw with the financial meltdown of the last few years, sometimes letting the free market work leads to chaos. So I wonder how, when you look back on the past few years, you decide where we draw the line.
Well, I did also say that government has a role in regulating, right? So I'm not taking it to an extreme where I say it's only market forces. But all that being said, if you look at the start of the financial collapse, you have to go back to the real estate market. You have to go back to subprime lending. And there, it was particular policies by the Congress, led in many cases by Barney Frank, to extend homeownership even to people who couldn't afford the loans, which were then bundled and resold. And so you have to point out that government policy was also a big factor in the crash. So it isn't all just market forces. It isn't all just government policy. It's a combination of the two. And making those things work is the real challenge.
You've said government does have a role in the markets to some degree. Now, we just saw this week Attorney General Martha Coakley step in and put a freeze on foreclosures to prevent banks from taking back houses before they reviewed the specifics of a certain possible foreclosure. Do you support that kind of intervention, the kind where Coakley steps in and says we're going to freeze foreclosures?
Absolutely. If there isn't sufficient understanding that processes, that due process has occurred, that a bank has actually looked at the details of a specific foreclosure, then yeah, it is proper for government to intervene. Just as we have criminal proceedings for individuals committing crime, we certainly need government involved, not in a criminal way, but certainly in a policing function in certain types of transactions or markets.
Sean Bilott, you used to be a Democrat. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you were registered Democratic as recently as 2005. What happened? Why did you switch?
You know, I was thinking this during the introduction. When I was in college and shortly after, people would say, NPR is so liberal. And I'd say, no, there's no bias there whatsoever. And I'd read the New York Times and I think the same thing. Now when I listen or I read the New York Times, I feel a little bit differently. What's happened over the years is just my thinking shifted. I think that happens to a lot of people. They find that the party they grew up in doesn't continue to fit their current beliefs. We've seen that across this district. Otherwise, Scott Brown wouldn't have won here. There's a lot of people who grew up Democrats. They find that they are not getting the leadership that they'd like to see. They're not seeing the focus on economic growth and fiscal discipline that they'd like to see. And so they're shifting.
Let me bring in a caller who wants to raise how you compare yourself to your opponent. This is Nick from Watertown. And Nick, what's your question for Sean Bilott?
So my question essentially is, what is it that really separates you both from Congressman Frank, who, you know, you said that he's won because there's never been a great challenger, but he's also won because he's been pretty popular for what he's done for the state and the nation. And what separates you from, say, the Republican National Committee talking points? Because, you know, with the focus on the national debt and things like that, it sounds an awful lot like what we're hearing from the National Committee.
Well, I don't dispute. I think talking about the national debt's a very important topic. It's going to create a massive drag on the economy, which is going to hurt us all. So I think that's an important thing to note. There are good ideas coming from the National Party on both sides. In terms of what separates me from Barney Frank, it's my experience over the last several years. It's experience in business. I've kept people employed. I have helped grow jobs. I've helped grow companies. I've helped increase profitability. All those things are what we need to get this economy up and running. When I see what's going on in Fall River and New Bedford, where they have 13, 14% unemployment, it's tragic. We have to get people back to work. We have to give them the means to take care of their families, the means to push their lives forward and do all the things that people want to do. The American dream is about each generation doing a little better than their parents. And I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think we have to enable the conditions that allow that to happen. So what I'm bringing to the table is experience in business, experience as a Marine officer, a different type of leadership, and a belief in citizen legislators. I think people should go down to D.C., spend a couple years down there, and then come back. I think it's unhealthy to have people in office for 30, 40 years. They become detached from the problems that regular people are facing every day, and they start coming up with solutions that ultimately don't make sense.
You refer to your business background. I should note you worked full-time for iRobot, the robotics company at Bedford, until you quit to campaign full-time in October. And you have an MBA from the Wharton School, I believe.
That's right.
So that largely describes your business background, I believe.
Yeah. At iRobot, I was running a $100 million product line, 100 employees. And so keeping track of what we had to do to keep employment and grow jobs, and it was extremely relevant.
We have a question for you from a caller from Rosendale. This is Dan. And Dan, what's your question for Sean Bilott?
Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to ask about, you know, I appreciate hearing that you're, you know, in support of free market forces. And specifically what I wanted to hear about was, you know, of course, you mentioned regulation being very important. The most recent legislation that just passed, I was curious to hear how you would have voted on that and, you know, what you saw potentially that was good in it and bad in it.
Dan, do you mean the financial regulation bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, what I saw that was bad in it were a couple of things. First of all, it didn't address Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Right now, we have paid out $150 billion for those two entities, and we'll soon pay out $400 in the not-too-distant future, and estimates go as high as a trillion. So those are big liabilities to leave out of the reform. But second, there's one of process. It's a 2,300-page bill. Prior to it being signed into law, Barney Frank said, hey, we're going to need a fixer bill. In that 2,300-page bill, there's all sorts of things that just don't belong there. It's part of this process of how legislation is made in Washington these days, that different congressmen come and stick in different things, and then it leads to this massive, expansive bill that covers things that people haven't properly thought through. It also puts a lot of power into the executive branch among non-elected individuals, and I think that's unhealthy. I think we need to have rules and regulations that are responsive, to the American people through the electorate, through the legislature.
Sean, let me have you talk about some issues other than financial. One is don't ask, don't tell. You've said that you think the current policy works well and that you would follow the direction of the U.S. Defense Department. But yesterday we learned that don't ask, don't tell may be decided in the courts. Would a ruling by the judiciary against don't ask, don't tell influence your opinion? Would that change your mind?
Well, one of the things I've heard this morning as people have been talking about it is people saying, hey, I actually think they should get rid of don't ask, don't tell, but this is the wrong way to do it. A single individual who has no connection or involvement with the military shouldn't be able to override a 17-year policy. I think it takes a little bit more thought than that. The Uniform Code of Military Justice currently doesn't outlaw orientation. It says absolutely nothing about orientation. So there's a lot of hue and cry about the legal system within the military, but there's a superficial understanding of the issues involved. You know, people say, oh, the unit cohesion argument is bad. I don't make that argument. I make the argument that let's get the administrative impact figured out. Let's get the financial impact figured out. Let's get the Uniform Code of Military Justice implications figured out. A lot of those things haven't occurred, so it's premature to just say, let's revoke the policy.
One of the issues particularly important to the 4th District, which you're running in and which involves heavily Jewish communities like Newton and Brookline, is Israel and Palestine. You actually recently said, let me read this on your website, we may soon have to accept the unpleasant realization that the Palestinian leadership does not really want to coexist peacefully with Israel and that no amount of Israeli concessions will change that. So what, with you saying that, what do you think that means for the future of peace in the Middle East? Are you saying there's a limit to what we can expect?
In the near term, yes. Over the longer term, I'm optimistic, but in the near term, I see no signs that there is a civil infrastructure emerging among the Palestinians that would enable a meaningful peace process to advance. There doesn't seem to be any indication that there is a government that to which the Palestinian people are responsive, and that makes it extremely difficult to have any real negotiations.
You've said you have a traditional understanding of marriage. Does that mean you disagree that Massachusetts allows same-sex couples to marry?
What do you mean? Do I disagree?
Well, so Massachusetts allows same-sex couples to marry. Do you think same-sex couples should not be allowed to marry?
I think it should be subject to a legislative process or a referendum. I don't think courts should be in charge of making sweeping change. People seem to like it when they're on the winning side of the argument. But if a court were to then suddenly revoke it, there would be people who are upset about that. What we should do is we should legislate on it or have a referendum on it.
Briefly, let me ask you one more thing. You had said recently in an interview with the Wall Street Journal that you do not consider yourself a Tea Party candidate, although many people would describe your views as Tea Party views. So why not give yourself that label?
That's a funny one to me. Yeah, I have never thought of myself that way. There is a lot of the people who affiliate with the Tea Party, who consider themselves Tea Party members, have a lot of views that overlap with mine. But here in Massachusetts, anyway, I can't speak for outside of Massachusetts. The folks I've met are mostly, they get together once a month at a restaurant or a bar, have a couple of beers, talk about issues of the day, talk about things they're concerned about, and that's kind of the extent of it. So to say I was a Tea Party candidate, I don't even know what that means.
So you think the label doesn't matter, it's the views that matter, whatever label they fall under.
That's right.
Sean Bilott is the Republican candidate for U.S. Congress in the Massachusetts 4th District. On October 27th, Radio Boston will host a debate between Sean Bilott and his Democratic rival, Congressman Barney Frank. Sean Bilott, thanks for coming into the studio.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Up next, 2-3% of the global population suffers from one form of it or another. A closer look at obsessive-compulsive disorder. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.